Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind. Later on in this hour, we'll talk to a panel of experts to understand Prop 4, the $10 billion bond to fight climate change. And we'll hear about the electrifying moves heating up the dance floor at the 26th annual San Francisco International Hip Hop Dance Fest. But first, we want to hear the latest on our favorite Bay Area sports teams. The San Francisco 49ers hosted the Cowboys last night, and the Warriors season has just started. But will local sports fanatics be cheering or crying into their pillows as the seasons roll on? Well, here to break it all down is our favorite sports journalist and frequent guest here on State of the Bay, Steve Berman from the New York Times sports outlet, The Athletic. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Steve.
Thanks, Ethan. Thanks for having me on.
Always a pleasure. So let's talk about the San Francisco 49ers. As I mentioned, they hosted the Dallas Cowboys last night and they won. So their record is now 4-4. Now, fans started this year with high expectations after the team made it to the Super Bowl last season. Of course, lost in heartbreaking fashion to the Kansas City Chiefs, but they've been beset by injuries so far this year. And how are you predicting that the rest of the season is going to go?
Probably a lot like it's already gone. They're 4-4 right now, as you mentioned. And this is a team that has a very daunting second half of the schedule. The good news is they have some guys that are supposed to be coming back. They're hoping that Christian McCaffrey will be back after this week's bye. Debo Samuel is dealing with injuries pretty much every week, but he should be rounding back into shape here with that extra bye week. Juwan Jennings also coming back. Dre Greenlaw, a really good linebacker, should be back in a few weeks, hopefully. But they have a first-place schedule because they finished in first place in their division last year, which means they still have to play teams like the Bills and the Packers and the Lions. And it's going to be difficult. The nice thing for them is their division is not really that strong. Everyone's sort of muddling around at around the 3-4, 4-4 area. So they have a chance to sneak into the playoffs, but it's not going to be one of those times like previous years where they've gone to the Super Bowl where they finish as the number one seed in the NFC. It just seems like it's too difficult of a task this year.
You mentioned, Steve, all the injuries that the 49ers have struggled with. Their star running back, Christian McCaffrey, Brandon Ayuk's out for the season, maybe more with a horrific injury, Debo Samuel, Juwan Jennings, or other wide receivers. So it's been a lot of injuries. How much do you attribute their slow start to the injuries, or is there a Super Bowl hangover? Has Brock Purdy, their quarterback, played up to speed? What do you make of their middle-of-the-road record so far?
Yeah, I think the Super Bowl hangover is something I was expecting this year. I remember the way it was after they lost the Super Bowl to the Ravens back in 2012. They still were able to get to the NFC Championship game the next year, but something seemed a little bit off. And same thing with 2020, obviously a weird year for all of us. It wasn't any of our best years, probably. But the Niners had some difficulties that year, and it was really injury-related. They had so many catastrophic injuries, including to their quarterback at the time, Jimmy Garoppolo, that they just got buried by the time the final month of the season came. They're in a little bit better situation this time. I do think, though, that is difficult not only in an emotional basis, just coming back from a Super Bowl loss, especially losing to the same team twice in 4 years. But also, it's tough to run that gauntlet and play all those extra games at the end of the season. So then you put that together with a lot of weirdness during the offseason. You mentioned Brandon Ayuk. He didn't join the team, really. He was around during training camp, but he wasn't taking part in practices because he was holding out for a contract. He requested a trade. There was a lot of drama going on with that. I think there was some effects there. Trent Williams didn't join the team until less than a week to go before the regular season because he was looking for a different contract. Christian McCaffrey actually got a new contract himself, although that one really didn't have much drama attached to that. But there were a lot of things going on to the season where, you know, just generally speaking, people just kept saying the vibes seem off or the vibes seem bad. And nothing really that's happened during the season has sort of assuaged those thoughts. I think overall Brock Purdy's been pretty good considering he's been without a lot of his star skill position talent. I mean, Christian McCaffrey hasn't been there all season, obviously, with the Achilles tendonitis in both legs. Ayuk, when he came back, he wasn't really himself. He had a lot of drops and seemed like he was kind of finally rounding into form and getting back into the offense when he got hurt. Debo has been in and out with some injuries too. So I think considering what the team around him has been like, I think that he's played pretty well. except for really one game, that game against the Chiefs, where you could almost see him pressing and thinking that he had to do the entire thing himself, and it led to some terrible interceptions and maybe his worst game as a professional. But overall, yeah, this is a Super Bowl hangover along with a lot of other injuries, and what it's led to is 4-4.
So do you think they're going to make the playoffs?
I think they will, just because of the division that they're in. They already beat the Seahawks pretty handily. I don't think the Seahawks are a great team. They got handled pretty well by the Bills yesterday. They should have beat the Cardinals and the Rams. I mean, really, the reason why they're in the place they are right now is because they gave away those two games against the Cardinals and the Rams where they had large leads in the fourth quarter. If they hold on and win those games, they're 5-2 and looking like a team that might actually compete for a number one seed or a number two seed at the very minimum. I do think, though, that after the bye, they'll probably round some things into form here. They'll get some guys back. And this is a team that's had some bad starts in the past before. They had a team that went to the NFC Championship game during the 2021 season. That team started out 3-5. So this is nothing new for them, but it is getting to be at the point where some other players are getting a little old, and a lot of the extra games that they've been playing with all these long playoff runs are kind of coming back to bite them. But the NFC West is not a strong division this year. It's okay at best. So I think that they'll kind of squeak out the NFC West title, which will give them probably the number four seed in the conference.
All right. Yeah, kind of the last dance here for the 49ers, potentially. We're talking to Steve Berman from the New York Times sports outlet, The Athletic. Steve, let's talk about the Golden State Warriors now. They just lost their home opener last night after winning two to start the season on the road. Perhaps most alarming is that Steph Curry left in the fourth quarter with an ankle injury. Any update on his injury?
Well, right now they're going to reevaluate him on Friday. So he's going to miss the next two games. They said that it doesn't appear to be extremely serious, and if anyone is an expert on judging the seriousness of ankle injuries, it's Steph Curry. He had surgery on his right ankle many years ago. He's had injuries, he's had sprains to both ankles repeatedly through the years. A lot of times it's a situation where he's just got to miss a couple games, then he comes back. We'll see on this one how long it lingers, but the fact that he tweaked it during last night's game and then actually just took himself out of the game, that's not a good sign. You know, it's really minor when he's able to sort of run through it and tries to go up and down the court a couple of times and get it warmed up and loosened up and see if he can actually play on it. This time he knew no way. And the Warriors, to the point where they're already saying that he's out for two games and he's reevaluated on Friday, that doesn't mean he's coming back right afterwards on Friday. It depends on how his body heals. So I would say two games minimum, but it could be something that stretches longer.
Well, definitely not what you want to see with Steph Curry, given his history with ankles. Of course, the Warriors this year seem like they have a really deep team. Of course, they lost Klay Thompson, longtime star, so that's unusual to see them not have Klay on the team. But at the same time, it does seem like they have good depth. Do you think they have enough depth to overcome playing without Steph here?
I think they definitely have enough depth just in general. This might be the deepest roster that we've seen with the Warriors, maybe ever, just in terms of having 12 guys who can play. But their top-end talent is not really that strong. You know, one of the things that Warriors fans have been crying out for a couple of years now is to get a solid number two option. Klay was that option last year, and at this point in his career, he's not quite the same player that he was, especially defensively, but even offensively, he's very streaky. So he'd be up sometimes, he'd be down other times, and even found himself out of the starting lineup. They tried to get a number two option during the offseason. They were deep in talks with the Clippers, who I'm sure did not want to do anything to help the Warriors' chances to trade for Paul George. That didn't work out. They tried to trade for Lauri Markkanen on the Jazz. That's lingered and stretched out forever as Danny Ainge, the president of player ops over there in Utah, is wont to do. And they ended up signing him to an extension, the Jazz did. So they tried to get someone to sort of shoulder some of that burden as some guy who can actually score without help to help out Steph. And they weren't able to do that. It'll be interesting to see what the team looks like. I don't think that defense should be a problem. They have so many bodies and they're playing it really hard. They're playing really hard defensively and at a fast pace, but I'm not really sure where offense is coming from without Steph, because he just garners so much attention on the offensive end. Gravity is what a lot of people like to say, and without Steph to worry about, it's going to be a lot easier to defend the rest of the guys.
Yeah, he's a once in a generation player. Let's talk about baseball here. We got a few minutes left. Of course, the World Series is going on, and the Yankees are playing the Dodgers. Any updates on the San Francisco Giants and their offseason moves that might be in the works, particularly now that they have Buster Posey, the beloved player, now shifting to running the operations?
That's the thing. If it was still Farhan Zaidi as the president of baseball ops, then I could tell you pretty much exactly who they would try to sign and what they would be trying to go for. They would probably be in the running for Juan Soto and finish second, and then they would sign a bunch of guys to one-year contracts with player options who were either coming off injury or a down year and hoping that they could sort of recoup some of their value with the Giants before leaving. We don't know anything about Buster Posey and how he wants to build a team. He's talked before on the record about wanting to build from within, that the team that he came up with in the early 2010s had a bunch of stars that came up through the farm system. Guys like Lincecum and Bumgarner and himself and Brandon Crawford and Brandon Belt. I think that's his dream. The farm system right now, especially on the offensive side, isn't really jammed full of talent. Bryce Eldridge is a guy that everyone's pointing to right now as their number one prospect, but he just turned 20. He rose the ranks very quickly, but to expect him to be a middle-of-the-order hitter right away, you got to kind of question that. I think that he's probably going to look to deal from maybe some of that pitching side in the minor league system, because what they need to do is find some middle-of-the-order hitters that actually make you think about something. The Dodgers and the Yankees right now got a bunch of sluggers. The Giants are in a situation where they play in a park that's cold, and it's kind of tough, especially for left-handed hitters, to hit home runs. Guys are not going to sign there as free agents, the top hitters, so you need to trade for them. So I could see some trades in the works here this offseason, but until we actually see how Buster Posey wants to run a franchise, we're really just guessing at this point.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that unfolds. And then, of course, on the other side of the bay, the Oakland A's, they're officially gone. Is this a team you're even covering anymore? Any updates about the A's status with their, it seems like, perpetually in flux, stop off here in Sacramento and then maybe move to Las Vegas? What's the latest there?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's really no concrete plans about how the financing is going to occur for this Las Vegas stadium that we keep hearing about. The two main things that have happened over the past week or so: one, Major League Baseball has decided to scrap the ridiculously asinine idea of having artificial turf at Sutter Health Park in Sacramento. They wanted to do that because they felt like grass would get run through pretty poorly because of having both the Sacramento River Cats, the Giants AAA team, and the A's playing pretty much every single day during the summer. But artificial turf, not only is it not as good on your joints and all that kind of stuff, but Sacramento summers are extremely hot. This is an outdoor park. I mean, I went to a game this summer, and it was probably one of the coolest days of the summer, and it was like 95, and the seats are scorching hot. If we're talking 115 degrees. That means on AstroTurf, it feels like 130, 140 almost. So luckily, they're going to have grass. They're going to replace the grass if they need to. That's a good thing. The other thing is reportedly, John Fisher, the A's owner, not the most popular person in the Bay Area for a lot of reasons, he has reportedly put up a chunk of his team for sale. He wants to sell, I guess, 25% of the team for $500 million is what's being reported. That would put the A's valuation as a team at $2 million. All the sites like Forbes that actually put numbers on team valuations say the A's are about $1.2 billion. So this would be an inflated price for 25% of the team. Shows that John Fisher is having a hard time pulling money together to get this Las Vegas thing going. So who knows how long they're going to be in Sacramento.
Well, we know he definitely doesn't like to spend his own money on teams. So not surprised that he's passing the hat, in case any listeners are interested in a $500 million investment in the whatever they are, Oakland/Sacramento Las Vegas A's. Well, thanks for covering that. We're just about out of time. Want to chat with you briefly about soccer. Just last question here. Bay FC, the women's professional soccer team, they're poised to make the playoffs. Any thoughts about this inaugural season for them?
Well, for any expansion team in any league that you talk about, having a chance to make the playoffs as the season's drawing to a close, that's pretty awesome. And everything that I've heard about this team is that, you know, they're not like a winning team so far. I mean, their goal differential is minus 11, but they won their last game and 1-0 on a nice indirect kick that led to a goal. And I think that this is actually just a wild success story so far. The fact that they're averaging like over 13,000 fans per game, which I think is fourth or fifth in the league, in the NWSL, that's strong. You know, I mean, and then we're going to see it with the Valkyries when the Valkyries start up next season. That the fan support for that team is going to be through the roof. So women's sports, there's been a need for it in this region for a long time. I'm surprised that took this long for this area to get a WNBA team especially. But yeah, people want to support women's sports around here. And yeah, the fact that Bay FC is actually going to go to the playoffs in their first year, that's always a success story for a brand new team.
Well, so much we could cover. Really appreciate you joining us. Steve Berman, sports journalist for New York Times outlet The Athletic. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks always, Ethan.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll continue our election coverage and dig into Prop 4, the $10 billion climate bond on the ballot. We'll have a panel of experts standing by to help you decide how to cast your vote right after this break. So stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. We'll hear about the effort to recall Alameda County District Attorney Pamela Price.
Even though she has a 6-year term, from the very beginning, she's kind of been in election mode, knowing that this recall would happen.
An update on the recent controversies, that's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Hi, I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. On Tuesday, November 19th, join us for a live recording of Philosophy Talk on the Stanford campus.
We'll be thinking about Mayan philosophy with Edgar Garcia, author of Emergency, reading the Popol Vuh in a time of crisis.
This event is free and open to the public. Everybody welcome. More information at philosophytalk.org.
That's Tuesday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Stanford Humanities Center.
Mull over Mayan mythology with us.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we want you to be a part of this next conversation. We're going to be talking about Prop 4, the $10 billion bond to fight climate change that's on the November ballot. How do you plan to vote, and why? Well, we'd love to hear from you, so you can give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also find us on social media if you want to leave a comment there, or email us with your thoughts about Prop 4 at stateofthebay@kalw.org. So as we near Election Day, we want you to feel informed and ready to cast your vote as our State of the Bay listeners here. So in a continuation of our election coverage, tonight we're going to look at the details of Prop 4, the $10 billion bond to fight the effects of climate change here in our state. Now, where would this money go? Which communities would benefit most from these funds? And how will it affect life here in the San Francisco Bay Area? So we're excited to dig into the details of Prop 4, and we have an expert panel here to help you decide how to cast your vote. So first up, we're excited to speak to Ari Plotka, the climate and environment reporter from the Sacramento Bee. Welcome, Ari.
Hi, thanks for having me, Ethan. Happy to be here.
Yeah, good to have you with us. And next up, we have Allison Chan, the political director at the nonprofit Save the Bay. Welcome, Allison.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, we're very pleased to be joined by Sarah Atkinson, who is the Hazard Resilience Senior Policy Manager at the nonprofit SPUR. So welcome to you, Sarah.
Hi, Ethan. Good to be here.
So, Ari, let me start with you. As a journalist who has covered Prop 4 really from its beginning, can you just start us off here by explaining exactly what is in Prop 4?
Yeah, of course. So Prop 4 would authorize $10 billion, like you said, in debt for the state to spend on climate and environmental projects. Most of this spending, or a lot of it, is about $3.8 billion is for water projects like storage, reuse and recycling, cleaning contaminated aquifers, and protection from droughts and floods. The bond also earmarks roughly $1 billion chunks for wildfire prevention and forest resilience, coastal protection from sea level rise, and then hundreds of millions for the clean energy transition, extreme heat, habitat restoration, and agriculture. So we're talking about a lot of money for a huge swath of projects. And repaying it is likely to cost the state about $400 million a year over 40 years, meaning taxpayers are on the hook for about $16 billion over time, according to a legislative analysis.
And Ari, can you talk about the journey of how this, how these different expenditures got onto the November ballot? I mean, this is, these are expenses that could have been legislated through the general fund, correct?
Right. So much of these programs, these projects were actually cut this year from the state's budget. So the prop, on one hand, it fills a hole that was made by budget cuts, because in 2022, during a budget surplus, Governor Newsom and the legislature approved a $54 billion multi-year spending package on climate, but then cut it back this year to $44 billion because the state faced a budget shortfall. So opponents of the bond, and there are some, they say that this is fiscally irresponsible and that this spending should really be coming from the state budget. Its supporters say that not only does it cover those cuts, but the bond helps California respond to the effects of climate change without being captive to the state's naturally volatile state budget.
Well, let's get into some of the arguments here about Prop 4. Sarah Atkinson, let me start with you. You're the Hazard Resilience Senior Policy Manager at the nonprofit SPUR, as I mentioned in the intro. And I know your organization, your job specifically, is about working to combat climate change. So what is SPUR's position on Prop 4 and why?
So SPUR puts out a voter guide during these election cycles. And for Prop 4, we are recommending a yes vote. That's because we really think that this investment, although it will cost more over time for the state, it really will prevent future costs and damage from a changing climate and from natural disasters that we are unfortunately seeing more of every day across the country and in California. And we really need to be focusing more on a disaster prevention and preparedness strategy. Right now, we have a bit more focus on disaster response, and Prop 4 is really a movement towards disaster resilience and prevention. And one number that I think is really valuable to talk about is the National Institute of Building Sciences estimates that natural hazard mitigation saves $6 on average on future disaster costs for every $1 spent. And that's, you know, a really interesting comparison when we're thinking about how much this could cost the state now and in the future.
And Sarah, I think you have a pretty unusual job title, I'd imagine, Hazard Resilience Senior Policy Manager. Can you talk about what hazard resilience work involves and how that's a part of fighting climate change?
Yeah, so my work is across climate issues, and I also do work on seismic safety. So some of that is thinking about how to make our housing stock resilient. SPUR is really focused on housing access and affordability and making sure that people aren't displaced from the region. We also are thinking about how to advance local planning around, for example, sea level rise adaptation. There's some regional efforts going on to make sure that we have kind of a overhead priority priority goals around what we want to see the region do. And we are part of those conversations and trying to guide that process. And there's a lot else in hazard mitigation. But for me, yeah, hazard resilience is really focused on mitigation efforts, nature-based solutions to climate change like flooding. A whole slew of things.
All right. Well, Allison Chan, let me bring you into this conversation. You work at Save the Bay, whose stated mission is to protect and restore San Francisco Bay for people and wildlife. And I understand that your organization is also recommending a yes vote on Prop 4. So can you explain how this money addresses the issues that are specifically related to the San Francisco Bay and why you're recommending a yes vote on it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, climate risk is prevalent in the Bay Area, everything ranging from drought to wildfires to flooding. But when it comes to flooding, both from sea level rise and from storms, the Bay Area actually has the majority of the state's risk. And in fact, San Mateo County, I believe, is the county that faces the most risk from flooding because, you know, it has two coastlines, one on the Pacific and one on the Bay. So flooding is a huge focus for Save the Bay's advocacy work. And because of the deep cuts to the state budget for coastal resilience work, we are extremely excited for the prospect of Prop 4 to fund the kinds of solutions we need to ensure that our communities and infrastructure and bay habitat can be resilient to the impacts of both sea level rise and flooding from storms. Sarah mentioned nature-based solutions. One of the best strategies we have at our disposal in the Bay Area to protect shoreline communities and infrastructure from flooding is to restore wetlands. And we've been doing a lot of that work, but it's expensive work. And the State Coastal Conservancy, which funds a lot of that work, again, took a really big hit in the budget and couldn't finish many of the projects that it had planned to begin funding. In fact, there are already $600 million in identified wetland restoration and other nature-based flood solution projects in the Bay Area. And that's just what's identified now, waiting for funding, ready to be constructed. So a lot more work needs to be done. And we're really eager for Prop 4 to be successful so that we can get started on these critical projects to protect our communities from flooding.
All right. Well, if you're just joining us, this is State of the Bay on local public radio, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing the $10 billion climate bond on the ballot. How do you plan to vote? Do you believe this is good fiscal policy for California? We'd love to hear from you. You can join us anytime by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us with a question or comment on Prop 4 at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we have an email question from Kate in Hayes Valley, who asks, doesn't the federal government pay for climate mitigation? Why is our state responsible for these costs? And Sarah, maybe I'll direct that to you first, and then Allison would love to hear you weigh in as well.
Yeah. So yes, the federal government, FEMA, for example, has a hazard mitigation grant that local jurisdictions can access. But it's really challenging to access that funding. It can come really slowly. It's limited. It's limited in scope and also in how much you can access. There's also a limitation on the types of projects that you can do with federal dollars. So we can't rely on the federal government for all of the funding that we need in California. We're one of the most exposed states to climate change, and we really need to be thinking about how to fund this at the state level. And I think in the long term, we're also going to have to think about more funding at the local level as well. We're kind of needing a multi-pronged approach to reach all the to meet all the needs that we have for funding.
And Allison, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'll just everything Sarah said is super helpful, and I'll just add that, you know, the EPA's San Francisco Bay program recently grew in size, and that's great news for the federal funding needed to, you know, build nature-based solutions for flooding and other climate risks. But it, as Sarah mentioned, it won't solve the whole problem. And the great thing about Prop 4 is that the majority of that revenue will go toward existing state programs that already have a track record of success, that are already investing in communities, that know how to prioritize work across the state. And so by supporting Prop 4, you're supporting the programs that are already at work and already seeking to protect communities and infrastructure from climate risk. And so, you know, by taking advantage of federal funding and matching that to the greatest extent that we can with state and local funding, you know, that's what it's going to take to address the magnitude of risk to the region. A regional agency called the Bay Conservation and Development Commission estimated that for flooding alone, it's going to cost the region $110 billion to you know, build up resilience and be adapted. And that's just for flooding. So, so that gives you a sense of the scale, which is why we need investment from every level of government, from local all the way up to federal.
And we have another email in. Steve from San Bruno writes, I am a fiscal conservative, but also believe in protecting our state from the inevitable climate changes. I would love to ask Ari if her paper, Sacramento Bee, is making a recommendation on voting. So Ari Plakta, I know you're the climate and environment reporter for the Bee. What is the Bee's position, if any, on Prop 4? Has the Bee weighed in?
Yeah, it's interesting that you ask, that your listener asks. The Bee actually did not endorse Prop 4, but most major newspapers in the state did. And it's generally seen as fairly popular among voters. A survey by the Public Policy Institute of California found that 59% of California voters said they would vote yes on it. So the opponents, mainly Republican lawmakers, and the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association find it fiscally irresponsible to add more debt to the state and not put this in the state budget. But that state budget is really volatile because it's based primarily on income tax. So this is kind of the way California works. And we have seen several environmental bonds in California in the recent past, never one this big. And they've all been spent down. But a decade ago, and in 2018, California voters did pass bonds like this, not for climate specifically, but environment. So the state does have a record of this. But no, the Sacramento Bee did not endorse Prop 4.
Well, that's pretty interesting, Ari. And I appreciate you bringing up the opposition arguments, because, of course, Sarah and Allison and their nonprofits are recommending a yes vote. So we did want to hear about the opposition arguments. Is it mostly then about fiscal policy? I mean, is anyone actually objecting to spending the money on the water projects, wetland restoration, wildfire mitigation, et cetera? Or is it really just a fiscal concern?
My reporting shows there's very little opposition to the spending on these issues themselves. There's broad support for it. And also in response to the previous listener's question, we are seeing just threats to really the state's climate agenda this election, with California's waiver program on vehicle emissions and potential changes to federal agencies like the EPA if President Trump were to get a second term. So from just talking to state leaders and lawmakers, they're seeing this bond as a funding cushion for the state's climate agenda that's really coupled with the Inflation Reduction Act money from the Biden administration that will be coming in the coming years.
And Sarah, let me go to you to get your response to this idea that Prop 4 is not good fiscal policy. Any thoughts in response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all groups that are in support of Prop 4 would also like to see this funding in the general fund and not have to be a bond measure. I think this is unfortunately where we're at in terms of the state budget's deficit this year. It's very possible we're going to be in a budget deficit next year, and some funding for these programs that will be funded hopefully by Prop 4 has been delayed to next year and could be cut next year. In some cases, has been pushed and delayed to next year and could also be cut next year. And that's another moment where we're just going to be delayed in moving forward on these projects. And I also think that it's important to think about the long-term impacts of this. We do a lot of this type of investment through bonds, infrastructure bonds. This is similar to an infrastructure bond. A lot of this actually is going to be hard infrastructure. Some of it is also going to be nature-based infrastructure, which I think is a really valuable thing, and we should be funding more of that. And so it's a way that we have funded these types of projects in the past, both for environmental infrastructure, but also for other types of infrastructure.
And Allison Chan, political director at Save the Bay, thoughts about these arguments against Prop 4? What is your response to those arguments?
Well, you know, I'll go back to something Sarah said in the beginning, which is inaction comes at a cost. And if we don't act now, you know, we're starting to see the impacts of climate change in our region already. You know, regular flooding is common now in places like East Palo Alto, in parts of Marin County. Cities are having to raise their own fees to try and upgrade and better maintain their stormwater management infrastructure so that city streets and schools and intersections don't flood. I mean, it's happening now and it's costing money now. And our cities are not set up to pay for these costs. So, you know, the failure to take this action will very likely to lead to much higher costs in the future. But by investing now, we can not only avoid those costs, but when you're talking about costs, you're actually talking about people, about livelihoods, about homes. You're preventing displacement, which is already such a huge and critical issue for the entire state and absolutely here in the Bay Area. You're protecting schools, you know, which are huge community assets. So sometimes it's helpful to not just think about the price tag, but to really think about what at its core we're investing in. We're investing in retaining our communities and preserving the ability for Bay Area residents to live here and protecting the most vulnerable communities from these climate risks. Mm-hmm. So to me, the price tag, although significant, is 100% justified.
All right. Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Ethan Elkind, and we're discussing Prop 4 with Ari Plakta, the climate and environment reporter from the Sacramento Bee, Allison Chan, political director at the nonprofit Save the Bay, and Sarah Atkinson, hazard resilience senior policy manager at the nonprofit Spur. We would love to hear from you. What are your questions about Prop 4? We just got a few minutes left, but you can call us at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We have Brian in San Francisco who writes, you mentioned money goes towards safe drinking water. How is that related to climate change? Sarah Atkinson, let me direct that one to you.
I mean, first, this bond is bigger than just climate investments. There's also investments for parks, opening new parks. And although I do think that drinking water investment, it does have a relationship to climate change. It's earlier this year, there was a report that came out that showed that about 1 million Californians don't have access to clean drinking water. So this investment really gets at that issue, trying to think about, basically access to clean drinking water. That's a fundamental right, and something that we should be investing in, and something that is an important piece of infrastructure. And we that also has a relationship to drought and the resilience of our drinking water sources. For example, snowpack. As it gets hotter, we're going to have less snowpack. We already do have less snowpack, and our water sources are can be dwindling. And so this is funding investments into protecting those water sources.
And we're just about out of time, but Allison Chan from Save the Bay wanted to ask you if you could just mention a highlight project that would benefit here in the San Francisco Bay if Prop 4 passes. You mentioned some of the wetlands restorations. I'm wondering if there's anything specifically that really illustrates the impact that Prop 4 could have in the Bay Area specifically.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many great projects ranging from, you know, small and very local to regional. But what I will point out is an ongoing project that will benefit from this investment, which is the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project. This is the largest project of its kind on the West Coast. You know, for people who might not be familiar with us with what a salt pond is, when you're flying into SFO or Oakland International Airport and you see the strange shapes in the bay, that where the water is different colors, those are salt production ponds, most of which are not being used for salt production anymore and can be turned back into wetlands, which is what they were in the first place. So by restoring those wetlands back to some functioning ecosystem, it provides a lot of natural flood protection and also, of course, invests in the ecological health of the bay. So this is a huge, huge project, and it's going to span over many years. And that is one project that will continue, would continue to grow and protect communities should this funding become real.
Well, and we have one caller that I think we could take before we have to break, a caller from Santa Rosa. I'm not sure I got the name, but wanted to welcome you to State of the Bay.
Oh, hi. I was just wondering if there has been any linking of this proposition to insurance companies bringing back homeowners' insurance at a more affordable rate if we are proactively going after what is happening with regards to climate change.
Yeah, well, and I know your name is Jen. I'm sorry I didn't get that the first time, but Jen, thank you for dialing in with that. Ari, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to see if you wanted to respond to how this could potentially relate to insurance and any final thoughts you want to add about this proposition before we have to end the segment, unfortunately.
I think the main connection there is really wildfire prevention efforts, things like forest thinning and prescribed burning that will ultimately make California's forests and the wildland urban interface where most Californians live under threat of wildfire risk will become hopefully more wildfire resistant, which in turn I think would help influence the insurance market. But I don't think there's anything in the bond, as far as I know, specifically related to home insurance and wildfire insurance. I also want to make a correction to my earlier statement. The B actually did endorse Prop 4. It was kind of had some criticisms, but they did endorse it.
And Ari, yeah. Real quick, any polling you want to report on just in 10 seconds here on how the proposition might do next week?
I think just that one Public Policy Institute poll, that the survey that found that 50% of voters are likely to vote yes. So it seems fairly popular.
All right. Well, we're going to have to end this here, but thank you all so much. Ari Plotka with the Sacramento Bee, Allison Chan with Save the Bay, and Sarah Atkinson with Spur. Thank you all so much for joining us and explaining Prop 4 to us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
All right, and coming up after the break, my co-host Grace Wan talks to the dancer, choreographer, and producer extraordinaire who created the San Francisco International Hip Hop Fest. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. for an ongoing series on Project 2025. This Heritage Foundation-led plan lays out an agenda to transform the country into a Christian nation. Project 2025 would dismantle the administrative state and ensure arch-conservative rule for decades to come. It would affect all aspects of life and would be implemented by expanding presidential powers and eliminating federal agencies. Join us on Mondays at 7 p.m. here on KALW.
This week in This American Life, when Joe went away to college to seem more sophisticated, he told everyone his family was vegetarian. Then he figured, why not try it out?
You know, then I sort of bought myself my first pair of sandals and I bought fatigue shorts. That's why, I mean, as far as I was concerned, I was Che Guevara at that point.
Pulling a hoax on yourself this week on This American Life.
Tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock for This American Life. On 91.7 KALW.
Creep on in, on in, on in. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight we're joined by Micaiah, the visionary behind the San Francisco Hip Hop Dance Fest, happening right here at the Palace of Fine Arts, November 9th and 10th. Micaiah is a dancer, teacher, choreographer, director, and producer. She's a multi-hyphenate. She's also been named the best dance teacher by San Francisco's Bay Guardian. And Micaiah is here to tell us what to expect at the Hip Hop Dance Fest. Welcome to State of the Bay, Micaiah.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you founded this San Francisco International Hip Hop Dance Fest 26 years ago, and you remain its artistic director. Tell us a little bit about the dance fest itself. What can an attendee expect to see?
Well, the San Francisco International Hip Hop Dance Fest is the first festival of its kind that honors the artistry of hip hop dance and the works of art that they create on a world-class stage.
And did you, you must have seen a need for something like this. So where did the inspiration come from?
26 years ago, it was, I guess it, I never really said that there was a need, but now that you mention it, I would say yes, because 26 years ago, there was nothing like this. And the thought of hip hop dance artists performing on a stage and people coming to watch and paying and sitting down like they would ballet was really unheard of. And there was a lot of connotations about hip hop that was negative. So I was a witness to magnificent performing artists that were not getting their respect, not getting their recognition. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, in a nutshell.
Yeah. Well, I mean, over the last 26 years, we've certainly seen how hip hop has influenced dance, music, just the way we dress. I'm curious how, in your mind, as a dancer and a choreographer, has the genre changed since you began the festival?
We say at the Dance Fest, at the SF International Hip Hop Dance Fest, that we honor the legacy and the origins, but we also encourage evolution of the art form. So, you know, we see certain new styles kind of jump off of older styles or other styles, or which is kind of just the evolution of different types of art in general or anything, you know, that nothing is exactly the same as it was when it was created.
We talk about sometimes there's Bay Area hip hop, right? There's a Bay Area sound. Is there a Bay Area dance or a kind of way of dancing that is unique to this region?
Absolutely. When you start talking about strutting, that the BRS styles, the and then now turfing, that's all Oakland and San Francisco. And so you start talking to some of the legends and the creators, they're very quick to claim the regions. I learn all the time when I'm speaking to people like that.
Well, I'm learning right now, so you're going to have to break this down for me. What is BRS?
Boogaloo, roboting, and strutting.
It's everything all in one.
Well, yeah, I think that they're different things. And so they have an organization called BRS, and that's what the BRS stands for. And the strutters, you know, it's a Bay Area thing.
It's a Bay Area thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, is it a particular style? And if I was strutting, what would I be doing? I mean, explain that for a radio listener.
Okay. So I think most people had heard more about popping. And sometimes people put popping with locking, but they're very different. I would consider a pop, like if you're popping, it's almost like a spasm so hard in the body that you stop. And it makes your body kind of stop, like I was going to say robotically or machine-like.
Mm-hmm.
So Boogaloo came from popping.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And tell me what turfing is.
Okay, so turfing is a younger style, T-U-R-F, taking up room on the floor. And you will see a lot of turf dancers sometimes at the BART stations, in the BART trains, in battles where they are competing for money or titles. And it originated in Oakland. And I have had a, you know, somewhat education about it from some of them. But, you know, there's so much to learn.
For this dance fest, are there particular Bay Area artists that we should look out for?
Well, so this year we have 10 total dance companies that are performing, and three of them are Bay Area, which is really legendary. And I love it because I love when Bay Area dance companies represent an international festival. And so the three Bay Area dance companies that are performing this year are Bliss. They are the one and only youth dance company. They're from Vacaville. We have Tribe from San Carlos, Tribe Crew. And lastly, String Jacket from San Mateo, California. And I go through painstakingly amount of watching many, many, many applications in order to curate this festival. And it is not easy. This year, we received 113 applications.
Wow. And what does it take to actually make the cut? I mean, I know you're trying to feature artists and you don't want it to feel competitive, but what elements are you looking for? What is the magical quality that allows a group to participate in this?
Well, I mean, it is a little competitive because out of 113, I chose 10.
Mm-hmm.
The places that these applications came from were Montreal, Detroit, Chicago, Colombia, Los Angeles, Paris, Cameroon, Singapore, Germany. So what I look for, obviously, extraordinary skill, dancers who have honed their art and their craft. And then outside of that, I look at the piece that they created that they want to perform at the festival this year. And that piece, if it speaks to me, if it's storytelling or some kind of statement, or if it's highly, highly entertaining, or somewhere a mixture of any of those, if it pulls at heartstrings, it makes you think, it makes you just want to boogie in your seat. To just show the sophistication and the diversity of the festival. That's what I look for.
Well, one of the features of the festival that really caught my eye was the freestyle dance contest, which is open to audience members, and whoever wins gets $500. And I am just curious. I'm thinking about entering my husband. I am curious who gets to judge that, and what are you judged on?
So we're doing that on the Saturday night show only, and did it last year as a 25-year celebration. And because we had so much feedback that people had so much fun, we're doing it again. And everybody that came on stage was just so effervescent and radiant. There were little kids, there were grandmas, there was everybody in between, and it was beautiful. And basically, they just strutted down, you know, and worked it out, posed. And then yours truly, is the one who makes the official judgment. But I have a turf dancer who's going to be hosting the whole
thing.
And her name is Talith Summerfield, and she's going to be hosting this whole contest on stage, just keeping the vibes high, keeping the vibes really positive. There's no judgment, no negativity going to happen that night.
I mean, it sounds so much fun. And another thing I want to ask you is, I mean, breaking was part of the Olympics in Paris this summer and got a lot of eyeballs onto that. I'm curious, I mean, you come to this from the world of dance. Do you think of it as a sport? What did you think about the inclusion of breaking in the Olympics?
This is just Micaiah speaking and no one else. I wanted to have my opinion. My opinion is no.
Yes.
But it's only my opinion. I don't consider it to be a sport. I don't. I'm an artist for the love of the musicality. But if you go to any B-boy, B-girl event, that's one of the first things that is judged is musicality. Not just, you know, athleticism or how many spins you could do or how high you flip in the air. It's the actual dance of it. So to me, there's more underneath all of that than just pure 100% like, you know, athletic prowess.
You're a teacher and a choreographer. If I wanted to learn how to do these dances, where could I go besides YouTube?
You come to my class.
Oh, where is that?
So micaiah.com, M-I-C-A-Y-A. I teach at a couple different studios, and I'm one of the best beginner teachers out there because I think that I always wanted to have a teacher like me when I was growing up and when I was a dance student, someone that creates a safe space for people to come in and to take risks, to make mistakes, to ask questions, and to not judge themselves or each other.
Well, I am sold. I'm sold. Micaiah, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Listeners, the San Francisco Hip Hop Dance Fest is happening November 9th and 10th at the Palace of Fine Arts in San Francisco. You can grab tickets at www.sfhiphopdancefest.com. Micaiah, thanks so much for joining us. Congrats on 26 years, and I look forward to a great dance fest.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. Join us next Monday at 6 when we'll talk about how to manage anxiety around the election. If you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Katie Colley. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator. Coming up next, Project 2025 with Rose Aguilar after BBC Headlines. I'm Ethan Elkind. Good night, and thanks for listening.